by the people concerned, organizing maybe in part through the efforts you are making to ensure that we don't argue over these things and the fine points, but instead organize in behalf of all of our needs as local residents for subsistence hunting, gathering, fishing, and so forth. And that's all that I can say, except that there are many state federal issues which I would be happy to speak to if you wish me to.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Gall. Well, I have a couple of questions. You say that in Tongass National Forest, the planning by the federal government is impacting adversely on subsistence harvesting by local native people in villages nearby. Is it possible to be a little more specific about that? I was given to understand that you had a unified system in Alaska for regulating subsistence, that is unified in state fish and game regulation. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that?
Certainly. The subsistence statute as it stands today is a reflection of, among other things, the Statehood Act, and it does provide for a priority for subsistence use. Now, the definition of subsistence use remains something of a problem in terms of getting the state agencies to truly respond to the basic subsistence needs of the people. One example that I gave earlier is in the amount of a resource which can be harvested for subsistence use. For example, herring roe on kelp. I may be wrong, but I think there's a 10-pound possession limit for subsistence use of kelp roe. 10 pounds of herring roe on kelp is a very small amount and doesn't begin to measure up to the use that would be made of it if it weren't for that situation. Dealing with the commercial versus the subsistence possession is an issue that I'd rather not get into, because that's more of a matter of implementation rather than a matter of law. But I don't think the biggest problems in terms of federal management policies have to do with the allocation itself. It has to do with the impacting of the resource itself. One example on a very basic level is the water resource, which is a basic subsistence resource. Today in port protection, there is the possibility of litigation due to the fact that there have been delays in a particular area of timber harvest, which was alleged to impact the watershed at the community of port protection, which is not a native community, but it's been there for over 40 years, and the people who live there feel that they are permanent residents. Behind their community, there's a stream. On either side of the stream, there's forest. In mapping out the timber sales, and I don't think that there's a problem so much of volume as it is of locating those sales. Where the sale is located in such a way as to directly impact the watershed, the people in the community become concerned. The fact that they approached the Forest Service over a year ago and received a minor modification, and then continued and found that they couldn't get any more. They sought legal counsel, they came to the state, and went through quite a bit of effort, and found that they did not get sufficient support from the state to really get any sort of action. In the last days before the cutting was to take place, they approached the Department of Environmental Conservation and were given a stay pending a study by that department. And that department's study is not complete, but some of the people who had an economic interest in that sale are already moving into litigation because of the delay, not because of a sure loss of resource, but just because the delay was difficult for their operating schedule. And I'm not going to address the management policies and the proprieties involved, nor the competition among resource users, except to say that if you're going to have a particular resource development activity, it should be located in such a way as to not impact the subsistence resource. Another example is the community of Edna Bay. Again, this is not a traditional community, but it's an adequate case in point. It was a community that was populated as a result of a state land disposal and withheld from that land that was given to the state by the federal government was a parcel that's now going to be used for certain industrial activity. At the very same time, residents report that they've been denied permits to build a dock by the state because it might impact certain fish and game resources in that bay. Yet at the same time, the Forest Service is pressing to go forward with a particular industrial use of a site which incidentally falls right in the middle of the community. A similar circumstance is occurring at Hollis. Now, these are legitimate user group disputes. There's no point in saying that one user group should have a particular priority over the other, except when it comes down to subsistence. And there, ANILCA provides not just for the native people, but for all the citizens who live in these rural, remote areas, guaranteed access to the subsistence resource, and a proviso that no development take place which would negatively impact the subsistence resource without consultation with the local community, specifically the local Fish and Game Advisory Committee. And once again, although the Forest Service says, and I'm sure in some sense or another, correctly, that they do consult these groups, they are not being responded to sufficiently, and they're not being consulted sufficiently. Another example is the problem of firewood, local use of timber for building. The competition for wood in the Tongass Forest has become very extreme. The reasons are that there are some very large timber sales, and the competition is not, it's not a matter of conservationists versus developers or anything of that sort. It's a matter of the small operators who must bid against one another, having to pay $100 to $130 a thousand board feet, while some of the negotiated contract users are paying $3 and $4. This is also having a direct impact, that is the management policies of the federal government in the Tongass. It's having a direct impact on the native corporations' ability to market their products in a free market environment, because whereas they must pay all their road building costs and so forth in order to get those trees out of the woods, some of the operators on federal land are receiving some rather extraordinary subsidies. In fact, I think the ratio in 82, 83 of expenditure on timber sales in the Tongass versus stumpage revenues is about 13-1 negative. That is, $13 are spent by the federal government in implementing a sale for every dollar they're taking in stumpage in the negotiated contracts. This is creating multiple sets of competition and problems of competition between segments of the industry, but it's being felt very directly by those people who are looking for personal use sales. And since this land, as Mr. Hodge stated, has gone into the Tongass National Forest and was previously acknowledged to be native sovereign land, there's a very direct relationship to these federal policies and the rights of the communities. The communities that are feeling it immediately and drastically are, of course, the ones that do not have any corporation land base around them, because there, the citizen, if he walks 15 feet from his home, is in the Tongass Forest. But it's, I think, because of the severity that I use those as examples, but in the other communities, the traditional communities, the circumstances are similar with regard to uses of federal land. So I think in summary, I would say that the kinds of problems that are being created exist at the state level in the implementation of the fish and game laws that you refer to, insofar as the regulations on a site-specific basis often do not respond to the subsistence needs of the people and need to be modified in order to do that. But at the same time, the federal policies in the Tongass are not, I won't say that they're intentionally destructive, but they're certainly not sufficiently responsive to the various kinds of subsistence uses of natural resources.
Just one other question that you may not wish to make any observations on. Everywhere we've gone, people have, native people in villages have talked about sovereignty, that is, the exercise of certain limited law-making powers locally by their tribal councils. And they have in mind, as far as I can tell, the power, among other things, to regulate use of fish and game, because the clash seems to come there. You've been good enough to add another dimension to that, which you have here in Southeast Alaska with the federal, very massive federal presence in these national forests. But and just in the meetings we've had here yesterday and today, the question of sovereignty has come up. Let me just leave it with you. Do you have any observations to make about that as a means of coming to grips with this dissatisfaction that seems widespread?
I think that there are aspects of the sovereignty issue which go way beyond my experience, because I have no experience with the problems in areas outside of, and I shouldn't say problems, I have no experience with the sovereignty issue outside of Southeast. And clearly that is to say that I have very little experience with the sovereignty issue at all. However, one of the problems that I see, to which sovereignty is clearly, or the raising of the sovereignty issue is clearly a response, was in part stated by the previous speaker, and I think in part suggested by my comments, and that is that people live in a community, and they may have lived there for 10,000 years, and I've had the privilege of sitting with the elders who, as little children, have gone out onto that beach and collected that food, or walked off into that woods and so forth. And now decisions are being made every day outside of these communities, which have a tremendous and long-reaching impact on what the future of those communities will be. I think as long as that's the case, there is a real need for strength at the local level. I'm concerned about what is going to happen in 1991, when the possibility will occur that the land base itself of these communities could be dispersed and divided. When you combine those two things, when you combine the ability of the state and the federal government and the private sector in our society as a whole to impact a community, for example, if you combine the existence of offshore drilling in Norton Sound with the possibility of a disruption of the land base on the shore, you have a very terrifying scenario for anyone who wants to live a pastoral, rural, subsistence type of lifestyle. Without a significant land base, you cannot guarantee subsistence activity. And even more basic, you can't guarantee the integrity of the community itself. So clearly, something must be done, whether it be by the people of the state organizing to ensure that the state protects the viability of the communities, or the people of the communities organizing to insist upon their sovereignty as communities. I'm not competent to address the solution at that detail. But it's clear to me that until we reach a stage where the people in each community can be secure in the knowledge that the basic forest resource, and I'm speaking of Southeast, the basic fisheries resource, the basic game resource is secure and safe, then there's always going to be the threat that it might not be. And that threat is going to be responded to by any means necessary. Sovereignty is one legal type of solution. Control of the state government is an alternative solution. A federal government that is responsive might create a little less tension. But no, I'm not able, because of the complexity of the issue, to comment on sovereignty. I don't believe it's something that the state can do without the federal government. There's no way that the state can develop a solution to that or even respond fully without a federal response. And that's unfortunate, but I think that's inevitable. I just would share one comment with you. The first time the sovereignty issue was raised to me was happened to be in Heidelberg. Yeah. And it was raised because of, it was raised during the time this crab issue was up, that here they had a bay, it was the only bay they could access with their skiffs, and the state was permitting people from another area to come in for commercial purposes to exploit that resource.
Where are you?
It wouldn't have created the anger it created if it hadn't happened a year before with abalone. The people would go out to a certain area, they would harvest the abalone. In would come, now the abalone, well, in would come the divers from the commercial vessels, and they would move into this area and clean it out. The people went to the Department of Fish and Game and they said, we are going to our traditional area to get abalone and we are being competed with unfairly by people with more elaborate equipment. And they were told to get some diving equipment themselves. Well, the solution isn't to get some diving equipment themselves. The solution is to develop a legal mechanism to protect the local indigenous use from outside intervention, if you will, or outside exploitation. And the issue that's raised is whose resource is it? Is it the public's resource? Is it the state's resource? Is it the nation's resource? With oil, it's the nation's. With abalone, it's the state's. But in the minds of the citizens who have lived there and are going to continue to live there, and I differentiate the people who live in the villages from the shareholders who do not live in the villages, because occasionally their interests are different. And my personal responsibility and my job is to represent the citizens of the area, the people who physically live in the village. And they need some protection. They need protection to decide whether the road is going to come in or it's not going to come in. They need protection to decide if they want the, like on Admiralty Island, to have their resources protected by being a park, or if they want their resources protected, as in the case of Haines, for example, by getting those allotments and not having to worry about control by an outside governmental entity. To me, I'm fairly well versed in the problem, but I'm not able to say what the language of the law would be to arrive at a solution. I think that the needs which would be responded to through sovereignty, with the exception of the lawmaking, which is also out of my area of expertise, but in terms of protecting the community, a solution must be found, and if no solution is found otherwise, then the sovereignty issue is going to become increasingly important to the people of the villages of Alaska.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gough, for
thank
those
you, sir.
Thoughtful remarks.
I would also, if I might, like to say to the people here tonight that I've expressed opinions that have been expressed to me, and I may have missed the point in some way, and if that is the case, I would hope others would come forward and help me, as they help you, to understand how I could be more precise. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, by all means.
My name is Nellie Bennett, shareholder of Oldville, BC, Alaska. But what I was wondering, I think the state of Alaska has a bill in, and what they would like to do is clear our land claims and our allotments, and it seems like so much of it has come to a standstill, and there seems to be not enough money to clear these titles. Do you know anything about it, or whether help will be coming along the way to clear these titles?
No, I'm aware of the delays regarding the issuing of allotments, the patents, but I'm not aware of any. I'm not aware that help is on the way, let me put it that way. If it is, nobody's told me about it. Yes, certainly. I'm not certain. I can answer any questions that come up, but
I'm John Martin. In regards to Mr. Gall's presentation, I'd like to ask a question. I'm sure that he'd be more than willing to participate. My question's in regards to Native fishing rights, which has more recently been diminished by limited entry. I know I've raised this question previously to the limited entry, which actually Mr. Gall is also aware of. I think it's really important that the Park Service that has been created in Alaska is to protect the wilderness so that the public or the people from all over the world may be able to enjoy. And in comparison with the people, I'm referring to the native people that's living in the rural community of Southeast. I think their right to live and to actually exercise their right to a livelihood in a fishing industry has been infringed on. By that I mean I really don't think that that the limited entry has really completed an adequate research prior to the enactment of the limited entry, as we know that the court cases actually reflect to this particular statement that I'm making. As we know that 70% of the total community was previously dependent on the fishing. And the only people that can actually apply for limited entry are those people that actually participate, or boat captains, for an example. Those crew members are actually also recipients in the fishing industry. And now, because of the cutback of the limited entry, has actually infringed on that right. I think I might leave that door open for Mr. Gall to actually be able to answer that particular question, because I think these people, the people that actually have really there is a key issue that's really in front of us today is there are people that want to open other areas for gillnet fishing and also seine fishing in certain areas that it's a continuous situation that Mr. Gall is relating to the Heidelberg situation. And I think he's touched on an area of sovereignty and also subsistence and state control and local control in regards to the fisheries, or subsistence for in all aspects, whether it's a harvesting of abalone, harvesting of gumboots, harvesting of heron roe, and so forth, because it's going to be a continuous power struggle in regards to who is entitled to what. The point I think I'm trying to make this evening is the fact that I think the people in the rural communities have a right to live without having to go to social services. I think if they had the right to work in the area that they have been previously well equipped, they're knowledgeable in the fishing industry. If they couldn't qualify for to fish salmon on a seine boat, they should have actually be considered for a hand troll permit or a gillnet permit or one of the fisheries. I think right now that their livelihood has been severed. They have no way to actually support that particular community or that particular family in that community. I think these are kind of things that we're being faced with. I think I'm not trying to disregard the right for American fishermen to come up from Oregon or Washington or wherever to come to fish in Alaska, whether it's for abalone or otherwise, as Mr. Gall indicated in Heidelberg. I think there should be some types of control. But I think I'll leave that there because I've been a strong advocate of sovereignty rights in regards to the native fishermen. I think that that particular is a new issue. I don't know whether the native people actually dealt with that on a federal level, or whether the state would have been probably a stronger advocate in that respect. So I'd like to leave that there, and maybe Mr. Gall can have an opportunity to actually hit on that a little bit more because I think a lot of people would like to have come forward and make those particular statements. Because I know for a fact that Icy Straits has been shut down for more than 15 years. And those people are being penalized because of the closure of the Icy Straits area and also the Chatham Straits area. We have a perfect example of the Juneau Cold Storage being closed today because the Northern District and the salmon fisheries has been closed because the Canadians actually raised an issue. The hand trollers has raised an issue. The gillnet fisheries raised an issue that the Icy Straits fishermen and also the Chatham Strait fishermen are taking their salmon. I don't really know who the salmon belongs to. The Canadians claim it. The Haines fishermen claim it. The Petersburg fishermen claim it. I really think that there should be some method of alleviation of as to identifying who does the salmon really belong to, who does the heron roe belong to, who does the crab or the abalone belong to. These are the questions that are really foremost in my mind, because you know that Icy Straits and Chatham Straits been shut down for 15 years, but the state of Alaska didn't do anything about it. They could have at least established a method of a hatchery. If it's really a dire emergency to shut this area down for 15 years, it's like the farmers, for an example. If the farmland is so depleted, they have a land bank. They let that land sit for a while until and they treat the soil until it's ready to grow some types of vegetables or whatever. I think we have a situation that we can look at as a yardstick. And Glacier Bay, for an example, is a park, and also right now I understand that no boats or any of these type of things can go in there. And in all due respects, I think I'm glad that I was given the opportunity to make at least a question to Mr. Gall so that he can actually enlighten us in that area. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know that I can be enlightening, but I could at least add a couple of comments to what Mr. Morton said. Taking some of these issues one at a time, first of all, the Glacier Bay situation. Have you been acquainted with this at all yet? Okay. Traditionally, the people of Hoonah and other areas had trolled in Glacier Bay. As a result of the declaration of certain areas as wilderness areas, specifically marine wilderness areas, and in order to enhance the of the place. There were a lot of different reasons why the federal government chose to establish some of these areas, and they created quite a good deal of conflict because they were interfering directly with the traditional uses of the area. As Mr. Martin says, as Mr. Hotch said, the area of Glacier Bay was traditionally an area of where people lived. And in fact, a friend of mine in Haines just went to see the place that was his mother's land, and it's there in the middle of the National Monument. It certainly creates some hard feelings. But when it comes down to the utilization of the fish, the restriction of certain of these areas has caused a direct economic and social hardship on people who live near the bay. And once again, the question arises as to how people who live adjacent to a particular resource should be treated differently from people who don't. And I don't have a clear answer to that. But what the federal government did by way of response was to arrive at theoretically at a compromise where some of the areas that were less used by the trollers were closed and the areas that were more used by the trollers were open. But the issue of deciding how the decisions are to be made remains. And they're being made politically, and they're being made from a great distance, and they're not being made in a purely social context in relation to the people who are indigenous people of the area. And of course, the history of European development in Alaska is so recent that you're not talking about people who say, oh, 200 years ago, my people lived there. You're speaking of people who are saying, we live there now, we lived there last year, we lived there 40 years ago. And there have been cultural changes around us, but why should our traditional use of an area be impacted because someone else has moved in and made some changes? And I think until the federal government begins to look at it from the perspective of the people who live here and have always lived here for that long, there's going to be a real difficulty for them to make proper decisions. I can't add much more to Glacier Bay, and before I go on to some more general fisheries issues, maybe you'd like to speak more about the Glacier Bay issue specifically, or do you think he understands what
it is? I think there's another point that we might hit on in Glacier Bay. The Seagull Lakes is probably one of the subsistence food that the Hoonah people, not only the Hoonah people, but a good majority of the native people throughout Southeast has actually utilized it. In various areas like Glacier Bay and also Sitka, Lazarus Island. But Seagull Lakes is one of the main food that the Southeast Native people had utilized. But I'm sure that during the confrontation prior to the Glacier Bay becoming a park, I'm sure that there were numerous testimonies heard in regards to Glacier Bay and how those subsistence way of life will not be disrupted. And this is some of the things that I think I told Mr. Gall that I'd leave the door open by raising this issue. Previously, when our people made those statements, now I hear another side of the coin now. We have new issues that's confronted the Native people in relationship to sovereignty rights. I think one of them is fisheries. The other was the subsistence use. I really have a strong feeling on about Glacier Bay as to this is where our Native people used to live in Glacier Bay. I think we have another example on the Anguson case in that's similar to the Glacier Bay situation. I think it's the Brooks Falls. The Department of Interior actually said that they had no right on that land, and yet the Angusons are the ones that had a smokehouse there. And from what I understand, that being a Bristol Bay fisherman, the Brooks Falls resort is probably one of the most prosperous resort in the Alaska Peninsula. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I understand that now that the Angusons' rights have been recognized by reinstating that case and it has gone to Supreme Court, and I'm sure that the Anguson has won. I think we have a similar situation in the Glacier Bay is what I'm talking about. The Huna Indians have previously lived there. It isn't as if that they're asking to go into the park to fish again since it's become a park. Our Native people from Huna has actually first established their community, their Native community in Glacier Bay for a purpose, and that was to survive. Of course, today we refer to that as subsistence way of life, to hunt and to fish. And I'd leave Glacier Bay at that now, but the other concern that I raised was another issue that we have no, our Western way of life now is actually confronting us. The subsistence way of life is slowly dwindling. So the people of Huna and Angoon actually had been involved in the fishing industry. And because of the new laws that are being enacted today, that too is actually threatening our Native people's way of life to make a living. If you take something away from it, then what do you do to actually replace that situation is what I'm asking. They want to take our subsistence way of life and also take our limited entry and restrict our way of making a living. And it's really something hard to bear, and the only time I think some people come forward is when they're angry and frustrated. Of course, I've had a great deal of time to think about this matter, so I'm not as angry as I should be tonight, because my father has been probably one of the leaders that have raised his concerns on numerous occasions. It was pointed out one point in time that the Huna fisherman was taking all the Petersburg fish that was coming into Frederick Sound. So my father invited any fisherman from the inland waters to come out and make a set in North Indian Pass on a 21-foot tide. It can't be done. You'd have to fight for your life, and a boat would sink right to the bottom. And it's a kind of a death-defying situation. And one of the reasons why the Icy Strait fishermen fished where they did was because they were fishing the Canadian fish. And none of the salmon that came into Indian Islands ever came inside. It was a milling ground similar to Noyes Island. of course, that's another issue. And not to deviate away from the limited entry that's confronting the two communities, I think that's threatened that community of being self-supporting in the fishing industry. I don't think the timber industry is really the answer for survival of these people that live in these two communities. So my thoughts are, maybe Pete can respond to that. If you trade off that, seems to me if you take a yardstick and say that 70% of the workforce that's in existence in the village of Angoon or Hoona, it seems to me that you didn't need to have public hearings to identify who is actually in the fishing industry in that particular community. Seems to me that you wouldn't sever that lifeline. You would then go back to the records and say who participated in the fishing industry in the past 20 years. Seems to me that you wouldn't cut their livelihood away from them. I think the state is leaving themselves open for a class action suit, and I think they'd win if they ever took this to court. But that isn't the purpose of my statement tonight. My purpose is to share with Mr. Gall so that he might be able to respond to the sovereignty fishing rights.
Thank you. Before moving on to limited entry, then I would just like to add a couple of remarks to give you some examples. The parks issue, for the most part, from my perspective, has to do with general issues of federal jurisdiction. And just because in the last few days I find these coming to our office on virtually a daily basis. And so just to pick the ones that are most recent, we have a situation which is occurring up in Skagway with what's called the Klondike something along the lines of the Klondike National Historic Park. It's a National Park Service operation there that deals with the Chilkoot Trail. When the federal government first came in a number of years ago in Skagway, there was a great deal of fear that federal jurisdiction would mean a loss of traditional uses of the area. And the federal government said, through its spokesman, oh no, we will protect all of your traditional uses. In fact, it's not even federal land, so you don't have to worry about it. There's just a little chunk of federal land in the middle of this park, and all the rest of it, probably 95% of it, is state land. Well, don't worry, the federal regulations don't permit us to invoke federal regulations on state land. All we can do is develop a joint administrative agreement which will allow us to administer this property. This will enhance your tourism industry, and you'll still be able to have all your historic and traditional uses. This year, after I guess about 6 years of these joint agreements, the Department of Natural Resources, without looking at the fine print, signed off on another 5-year extension of the cooperative management agreement. And what they found was that there was a change in federal regulations which allows the federal government, in fact requires that the federal government, implement its general park regulations on lands over which it has administrative authority, whether or not those lands are federal park lands. Consequently, by renewing the agreement, in this case for 5 years, the city of Skagway found itself in a position where the people who had traditionally hunted in a certain area couldn't hunt there, where some people had horses that grazed in a certain area, they couldn't graze there. Some people liked to play golf, and that meant digging a hole in the ground. They couldn't do that anymore. And so it went, you know, to the point of being almost ridiculous. The result has been first a series of public meetings and a large conflict, and hopefully backing off to some extent by the Park Service. Hopefully a compromise will be reached, but the point of the story is that this seems to be, sadly, standard procedure. That first the governmental entity will go in and say, don't worry, everything's going to be fine, and then over a period of years the rules change. I attended a public meeting there about a week and a half ago and I couldn't believe it, but the gentleman representing the Park Service stood up and said, hey, I can't take responsibility for what they said 6 years ago. And the people just went wild, and I think justifiably so. And I just choose that because it happens to be this week's example, but the Glacier Bay is a case in point. Fishing will be permitted in Glacier Bay. It's always been occurring there. When I lived on a boat in Glacier Bay in 1976, there were little fishing boats going back and forth, and it was lovely. And it wasn't until large cruise ships began to show an impact on the whales and other marine mammals in the area that people started thinking, well, maybe we better restrict motorized vessel traffic in there. Well, the cruise ships are still going up and down the bay, but the trollers aren't, or at least not to the same extent. So once again, it's a question of trying to reorient federal policy to be more responsive to local needs, and I think this is probably something that is nationwide in scope. I had another example too, but it slipped me, so if I may, then I'd move on to limited entry, unless you want to...
Well, Mr. Gall is still in Glacier Bay. I'd like to add, you know, what gives me the right to talk about Glacier Bay? I think this is a standard question to those who testify. My father and my brother is still alive today, he's in the audience. We built a log cabin in Glacier Bay in the Bursley Island. And and prior to becoming a park service, a park area, we were not confronted. The park people knew that my father built that log cabin there, and it's still standing today. We used to hunt goat and dry and smoke goat meat, and also put up seal meat in the same fashion. And that's the way my father survived, by supplying the communities of Hoona and Juneau with smoked goat and seal meat, and we kept it in seal oil. And that's the only island in the Bursley Island, incidentally, that has a spring. And the Tlingit name for it is Katikunikat, and that's where I remember. It's kind of like a dream where a youngster actually thinks about some of the roots and growing up and running around on a beach, and that's the way of life that I can remember. And I'm sure that my brother can also remember where he buried the pot that was previously used for Fox Farm. It was a great big cast iron pot, and I'm sure that Al was the one that buried that pot in that particular area, so nobody else would get at it, in the event that we had to prove our roots in that area. It isn't as if we just decided to live there. My father comes from Tlakuan, has settled in Hoona, and my grandfather's name on my father's side is Kakwa, and previously they were considered Hoona people, and from the Glacier Bay area, it isn't as if we just decided that for allotment purposes that we would settle in Glacier Bay. Our forefathers originated from Glacier Bay, and seems like we become penalized when they kicked us out of Glacier Bay. That log cabin, for numerous years that we utilized that particular log cabin, was disregarded by the Park Service. So I just, that was the main reasons why I made the statement. And incidentally, today, my grandfather, his name is Tom Martin, on my father's side. And we hold title to 160 acres in the Dundas Bay allotment. And that's still in the Glacier Bay National Monument, incidentally. And I lost my father and my stepmother and my aunt and my uncle in Glacier Bay several years ago. So those are the reasons why I think I have a right to talk a little bit about Glacier Bay. And we can move on to the limited entry.
Well, I will do that. And but first,
before you move on, I would like to raise a question.
Hi.
Mr. Gall, I guess, can elaborate. The Wilderness Act in the Glacier Bay, within the monument itself, cuts off quite the majority of the fishing area, historical fishing area, as a matter of fact. I am a longliner. I've fished for over 40 years, and I consider myself an experienced fisherman. The Bursley Island and the Newark Inlet area, and all the bays within the Glacier Bay Monument under the Wilderness Act, I believe it is, I testified before Park Service on the federal level before objecting to the closure of that area. The reason for closure of that area that we would be in favor of the tour boats for navigational purposes, so they can go in there and drop their hooks and fish and jig for halibut. It closed quite a bit of the area for longlining inside of Bursley Island. It also completely closed off the area of Muir Inlet. And that's one of the better crab fishers. I used to crab fishing through that area. So that leaves me out. And that leaves me out of an area where I used to go. I mean, there is just no ending to it. First, we have a national monument. There's a certain restriction on national monument. Now, you make the Park Services enforcers impose more restriction within the Glacier Bay Monument area, because you might damage the whales or the small turtles. They have a specific law that they take. And a commercial fishing boat at that time will be 3 days out of 12 months. Actually, 3 days of telling the fishing time. And we would be a menace to them, in that 3 days. Because that was the reason they're closing this area. And I strongly object. I do have a lot of information. My brother John is right that the Tommy Memorial roots come from that area. And I could elaborate some more if I wanted to, if you wish. Thank you very much. You might answer and
thank you. Thank you very much. I guess one thing I'd like to say, I can't make the claim to have had my family live in Glacier Bay, I'm sorry to say. But I think that this is the point that's basic to your question on sovereignty. That at some point, with all the talk about the family and all the talk about the family that we hear from the leaders of our country, it's about time that the federal government responded to the families who have lived in one place for a long time and recognize their rights to be. And I don't know the legal solution, but I would hope that from these kinds of discussions, maybe you could help us to organize an effort to direct the state and the federal government to have some sense of responsibility for the people who were here first, for the people who wish to continue to be here, for the people who can understand that there's a difference between commercial use and personal use, in the sense that the gathering for your family is just simply more important. And of course, the example just given, you know, in a manner of speaking, is commercial use too, but it's very different from a multinational corporation coming in and establishing an enterprise. It's very different from a fellow in a plastic boat taking out tourists for profit, who goes there and says, okay, sir, you're from Philadelphia, we want you to enjoy this experience, come out in our little skiff, jig for halibut. That use is permitted, but personal use of halibut is very restricted by the International Halibut Commission. Subsistence use of halibut does not exist under the law, and the traditional small boat commercial use of halibut by local residents is, as Mr. Martin just said, restricted now because of competition down to a few days. I'd like to speak for a minute, though, about the halibut situation, because it leads into the limited entry problem. Last year, we had the most incredible threat that I've ever seen, and it was a thing called a share quota system for halibut. And what that meant was, if you have a small boat, and you're catching, say, $5,000 worth a season, and that's been putting you through college, for the sake of argument, or buying clothes for your family, well, then you get a little piece of the quota, a share of the quota. And if you have a great big boat, and you've been catching $500,000 worth of halibut a season, then you get a great big share of the quota, based on your so-called historic use. But historic use, you know, means in the commercial, industrial sense. It doesn't mean in the historic sense that we're speaking of here. Luckily, for the moment, the moratorium on entry into that fishery has been postponed. And with that, the threat of a share quota system has been postponed, but it's going to come back. And the people who are going to bring it back are the people who have the financial means to control the politics in Washington and elsewhere of these commissions and the legislators or congressmen and presidents who put them into power. I have a certain respect for that, but I think it's just absolutely horrible to imagine that just because a person has the financial means to get a larger boat, that person should automatically have a right to a larger share of the fish. And although the three-day season for conservation purposes is a problem, and although the difficulties experienced by a fisherman with a large investment who goes out and is only able to catch a few fish before the season closes, that's a problem. But the problem of the people that I represent is that person with a skiff who wants to go out and catch a few halibut for sale and maybe make $1,000 that year, which could be the difference between, could make a very major difference to that person's life. Those people's interests are just nothing in the eyes of the thinkers who put together an idea called a share quota system. That's just one example of how a limited entry procedure could immediately cripple the financial existence of the small fishermen in the small community. And then, of course, when I raise that issue in public, people say to me, well, now, just a minute. You don't have to sell your share, and you could buy another share. And if you just work hard and year after year, pretty soon you could have a whole lot of shares. But economics doesn't work that way. Economics work with the person who has the largest amount of money going to the person who only has the little share and saying, hey, I'm going to give you $5,000 for your share. It would take you 5 years to earn enough money, you know, fishing, to justify that. And you get somebody when they're in a difficult period and they need that money and that share is gone, and you know that person is never going to be able to go back to the large operator who bought the share and say, oh, give me a little piece of your action because I need it. It just doesn't happen. And the point is that federal policy should be responsive to the local resource users' need as well as to the larger corporate need. And I would say that from the testimony I hear, and I rather imagine from the testimony you're going to hear, that some kind of change of philosophy in lawmaking to respond to the individual citizen with less means financially is very important in a world where money provides so much power. That's halibut in one particular, you know, situation.
By limited entry and shared quota, you mean the same thing?
Okay, let's then begin the limited entry. I would introduce it and then ask others to speak, because I can only speak about the form. The limited entry system started in Alaska for salmon. Its purpose was to protect the fishermen, and the politics that were used to get it through was to go into the villages and say, look, you're all fishing. You will have the right to obtain one of these permits. If we don't guarantee your individual rights to fish, then pretty soon everybody from the lower 48 is going to be coming up here to fish, and because we can't fish without limits, your share is going to become so small that it will be uneconomic for you to proceed any further. If you want your rights protected to fish, vote for limited entry. So limited entry became the law. And there were a limited number of permits to fish for salmon, and you can catch as many as you want. A share quota system would set a quota on the total number of fish caught and then provide you with a percentage of that quota based upon your historic use. So that's the difference between salmon limited entry and the proposal for halibut.
I might add to that too.
Please.
I'd like to see somebody else pose the question from the audience. The main reason is to get the audience participation in some of the subject areas that's being covered this evening, and that was one of the reasons why I asked
right.
Mr. Gall, and I'm very thankful to have that opportunity to ask questions. But I also like to give the opportunity to the people in the audience to also respond. But I'd like to hit on that limited entry while it's fresh in my mind,
please, so we can both participate.
Limited entry, the way I understand it, is no different than the Quinault Indians of the state of Washington. Judge Bolt actually recognized the treaty aspect. And incidentally, the treaty, as the way I understand, is the law of the land. It's like it is the Constitution, parts of the Constitution of the United States. The limited entry has a lot of similarity in Alaska, but I think it's probably more refined because of the Judge Bolt decision in the state of Washington. The limited entry represents sovereignty rights. Sovereignty doesn't mean necessarily Indian or Native or Alaska Native. Sovereignty pertains to those, to the people that actually has entitlement to that particular fishery. And this is the way I understand limited entry. Those people who participated in X amount of years, or state refers to it as the magic years, which I was strongly opposed to. Also, the most important issue that I raised is that if limited entry actually is passed, it should reside in the rural community and not be sold out of that particular community so that you'd have a tax base, an economic base, so that community can be self-sufficient, so it would be it would support itself. So those are the points that I actually wanted to raise, you know, as far as limited entry is concerned. But limited entry, again, fell short, like some of the laws that are enacted because of probably not enough public participation or that the hearing aid was turned off when the important points were being made or raised by the actual fishermen themselves, especially the boat pullers. The boat pullers, I think, are the ones that I'm really advocating today. Those are the people that are still fishermen, are trying to get into another area of work